So, welcome back to the Menopause Movement Podcast. I'm joined today by, I want to say Dr. Shahrzad, is that right?
Dr. Shahrzad Green, yes.
Shahrzad Green, yeah. Shahrzad Green, who is a pharmacist who specializes in menopause. And it's exciting to have you here on the podcast. You've been doing this for about 20 years. I'm reading your CV. Mm-hmm. So 20 years you've provided private consultations for hormone imbalance and perimenopause, menopause, andropause, PMS, PCOS, that's polycystic ovarian disease, postpartum depression using bioidentical hormones, adrenal fatigue syndrome, and sexual dysfunction. So it's great to have you here.
And well, thank you for having me here. I'm really excited to be on your show, and I'm glad that you're doing this service for all women out there.
Yeah, well, thanks. So I want to start with, tell me a little bit about your background, where you went to school, what got you into this?
Sure. Well, I went to school in Tucson, University of Arizona, and I graduated in 1990. So I've been a pharmacist for 29 years. And here's a summary of what I've done with my degree. First of all, I'm really glad that I did study pharmacy. I've done so much with my degree. So to all the pharmacists out there who are wondering what to do, there are so many options out there. But I did the retail setting where, I worked at a retail chain store. And then I did home infusion. Then I went into nursing home pharmacy. And at the tail end of that, I met my mentor, and I think that's where I got my biggest break, because he had been a compounding pharmacist for many years. He was ready to retire, and he gladly handed over the business to me.
Wow.
Which helped tremendously, because after I opened my own pharmacy, he basically worked for me, but he showed me the ropes. He took me marketing. He's the one who actually suggested to me. He said, you're so good at what you're doing. Why don't you do hormone consultations? And I'm like, what? That was 20 years ago. And he says, yes, you'll be good at it. And we started very kind of short hormone consultations. And then over time, we made it longer and more comprehensive, where my hormone consultations and for adrenal fatigue or sexual dysfunction, they have evolved to be a one-hour session, one-on-one. And I, over the past 20 years, I've probably seen close to 20,000 patients. I've kind of lost track.
Yeah. That's a lot, a lot of patients. And, when we work so much, it's easy to lose track of how many patients you see. That's for sure.
That's right.
So do you do any telemedicine or teleconferences anymore? Consults?
Oh, of course I do. So my main office is in Arizona, in Mesa, Arizona, but over the past few years, I've actually expanded to many different states across the U.S., and I actually do some international work too. I have one patient who's like the farthest away, and she lives in Saudi Arabia, and it's so interesting that every year she comes back with her husband for a visit, and they always make an appointment, a follow-up appointment. We plan to do the labs in advance, so when she comes for the appointment, everything is all ready to go. But yes, I do this across the country. And
do you have to get licensed in every state then?
No, because I'm not dispensing medications. In fact, I am a licensed pharmacist in Arizona and California. But what I do, I don't necessarily need a license, because I'm not the one who's making the medications or dispensing anything. So, which is kind of like nice, because then I can focus on what I'm doing.
Sure. So tell me, okay, so let's say I want to have a consult with you, right? So I'm in New York, you're in Arizona. So we do something similar to what we're doing now, right?
Right, exactly. We do a Zoom conference. What I usually like to do is and I'm in the process of setting up a new website where patients can actually go and fill out a form and fine. But essentially, when a patient contacts me, I usually like to talk to you over the phone or through Zoom first to see if you would even benefit from my services. So there are times, as you know, there's a lot of controversy with hormone replacement therapy and breast cancer and all that. So there are times that it's not really appropriate for a patient to be on hormones. And I do have different modalities to treat those patients accordingly and do different things for them to help their symptoms. But usually I start off by doing just a 10-minute short conversation and see how things are going and what things have been done. Have you actually had any lab work to measure your baseline hormone levels? If not, I can set up something through either saliva testing or blood spot testing for you, or you could self-order, or if you have a physician or a provider that works for, with you, then we could definitely go through them. I'll make a recommendation for those labs. After I receive the labs and your hormone consultation, your form, then I actually set up the meeting, which is an hour. And would you like me to tell you what I do during that meeting?
Well, first, before we do that, I want to talk to you about saliva testing, because saliva testing, depending on the lab, I mean, it can be hit and miss, right?
Exactly. So over the past 20 years, that's the advantage of getting old, because then you try all these different things and you which one's actually better.
Sure.
Over the past 20 years, I've tried many different companies. And can I name the name of the company that I actually use?
Okay. Yeah, sure.
I use ZRT Laboratories exclusively because, and I have no affiliation with them, by the way, but I use them because over time I started using them. I thought, well, this is too expensive. I tried a few different labs and every time I got very questionable results. So I went back to ZRT and I'm telling myself it's not worth the money that people save, because at the end, I want to see accurate results.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do ZRT.
Okay, so anybody who wants to get, let's say, a saliva test, what actually do you test in the saliva test?
For hormones, you know, there's different things, but primarily, first of all, we want to know where in your life you are as far as hormones. Are you perimenopausal? Are you postmenopausal? So for hormones, we usually like to check FSH and LH, which are the two gold standards for determining that.
That's follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone.
That is exactly right.
Okay.
So along with that, I like to check estradiol.
Okay.
It's one of the main estrogens, and then estrogen.
Precursor to estrogen. So anyone who's been through my course, we go through the whole stereogenic pathway and steroidogenic pathway. And so estradiol is one of the main precursors, but testosterone also.
Exactly.
Can turn into estrogen. So we kind of go through the whole biochemistry there in the course. So, okay, so you test estradiol, FSH, LH, and what else?
Estrone, which is the bad estrogen. It's like there are three sisters. When it comes to estrogens, there's the wicked sister that's, we think it's estrone. And then I also like to check progesterone.
Okay.
And testosterone. And on top of that, I usually like to check DHEA sulfate for many reasons, but that's another discussion. But that's for patients who come to me for hormone imbalance. Now, for patients who come to me for adrenal fatigue, then there is a different set, which includes a 4-times cortisol testing, where we would test your cortisol in the morning, at noonish, in the afternoon, and then before you go to bed. So those are primarily the two things.
So let's, while we're talking about adrenal fatigue, let's go ahead and just talk about that for a second. What is your definition of adrenal fatigue?
So basically the way I explain it's a simple concept. So you have a flashlight and you've plugged it in, it's recharged for emergencies, right? The power goes out, you go to the flashlight, you turn it on, you can make do, the light comes on and you can actually do your activities until the main power comes back up, or that stress is over, essentially.
Okay.
So that's your adrenal gland. Now, adrenal glands are there to help support us, to help us through everyday life plus stressful situations. But when we continue having stress, whether it's due to chronic illnesses or loss of a loved one, acute stresses, a divorce, moving across the country, not having any friends or support where you move to. So all of those things kind of make your adrenal glands work a lot harder than normal. And after a while that they work so hard, they basically lose their strength. They're not as potent as they used to be. Just like that flashlight, that after a while it starts dimming, right?
Yeah.
You cannot live on that flashlight anymore. You have to plug it back in. You have to re-energize it and wait for the next emergency. But oftentimes what we do is we keep carrying that flashlight day after day after day, and we try to use that instead of saying, okay, well, let's take a step back. Maybe I should cut back on my work. And I have a personal story that I'll share with you and your audience in a minute.
Sure.
But, you know, maybe I should kind of reconsider what I'm doing instead of pushing myself more.
So in terms of what you're testing only corticosteroids, right?
And DHEA sulfate.
And DHEA, which is, you know, precursor to testosterone. And but so just to be clear, we know that the adrenal gland does more than just produce cortisol.
We have the other
corticosteroids. Now, corticosteroids and the mineral corticoids, and the mineral corticoids are the ones that maintain your blood pressure.
Exactly.
And so we don't usually see fatigue on the side of the mineral corticoids. It's usually on the corticosteroids. And is there a body type that you see, like when people have adrenal fatigue, are you seeing more like belly fat or?
Yes, definitely. Kind of an extended midsection. And usually, you know, when I do the consults, it's very interesting because in this day and age, so many women come to me, and men too. I, by the way, I do see men as well, yeah. Not as many as women.
Andropause.
But, yes, andropause for men. So yeah. I see these people who come to me, and they complain oftentimes about being fatigued and tired.
Right.
Insomnia, they cannot sleep at night, or they wake up multiple times, and then the belly fat, the extended midsection. So when we do the testing, and actually, you know, it's kind of like when you interview them and you kind of in a friendly way ask them about their lives, their stress level, and how they de-stress, what their eating habits are, what their sleep hygiene is. So you put all of that together, and you know. A test is wonderful to have to actually see that pattern, but honestly, I can pretty much look at a person and say, oh yeah, I think, you know, he or she has adrenal fatigue syndrome.
Right, right. Okay. So when somebody has adrenal fatigue, so you see a little bit of, you know, you'll see a bigger midsection, but you know, women who are losing estrogen also have a bigger midsection because the body's trying to hold on to estrogen, right? So,
absolutely.
And so one of the questions I want to ask you, we're talking about estrone. Does estrone come mostly from belly fat, or is estrone somewhere else?
Well, I think it comes from fat, period, whether it's belly fat or elsewhere. To go back a little bit, you said something that was very interesting, and you hit the nail on it, and that's the relationship between menopause and adrenal fatigue syndrome, because oftentimes they go hand in hand. When we go through menopause, when we go through hormonal changes, that's a major stressor on our bodies.
Sure.
And I jokingly say that, well, we don't have the luxury of dying right at menopause or after menopause. When, you know, we used to, but now we don't. So we continue working, you know.
Yeah.
I'm postmenopausal. We continue taking care of our kids who may still be at home. We continue taking care of our aging parents. So life doesn't stop for us. So you add all these stresses on top of each other, and not only you end up with adrenal fatigue syndrome, but you also experience menopausal symptoms. So it becomes really complicated for
sure. Some. Yeah. So, so I'm just going to use me as an example because I know myself best. So, let's say that, I'm somebody who is you know, tried hormone replacement, didn't like it because I got a period. I wasn't going to do that anymore. Difficulty losing the belly fat, even though I exercise quite a bit. But I work at night frequently because I take call as a general surgeon, you know. Right. And so how would you treat that? I mean, obviously you have to do the testing. So let's say the cortisol is all wacky in the four cortisol. How would you treat that? Would it be an adrenal supplement? Would you supplement with, I mean, because the last thing I want to do is take steroids regularly, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And yeah. I usually, don't go to steroids. I'm pretty conservative with everything that I've done. And I think that's why I've been very fortunate with my patients over the past 20 years. I haven't had any major incidences where we say, oh my gosh, you know, we should have done it differently. I like a step-by-step approach. First of all, going back to the bleeding, I have to tell you, experience is necessary in this field. It's not just going off the books, but also your experience. When we start a woman on hormones and she gets a period, that's your body telling us it's too early. Don't give that to me yet. Okay. We have to be really careful. Either that or you're getting too much hormones.
Right. Yeah.
We have to be really respectful of your body. We can't just say, okay, well, you know, everybody who's having hot flashes, come here and get this dose and everybody's going to do well. It's not a cookie cutter approach. And that's why I like compounding, because then I can actually tailor. You know, there are patients of mine who get only 0.125 milligrams of estradiol per day topically from a cream. And then there are some women who are getting 1.25 milligrams.
Right, sure.
Difference. So everybody's different. Everybody's body composition is different. But looking at your lifestyle, for example, I say, well, yeah, of course you have adrenal fatigue. I have a theory. I say all of us working women definitely have adrenal fatigue syndrome. So that's sure. Just, you know, that goes with the territory. But yes, you do have adrenal fatigue. So what can we do? And that's another part of what I do, because again, with experience comes knowledge and expertise. And I say, okay, I want you to understand that I cannot just give you a pill and make your symptoms go away and your belly fat go away. Adrenal fatigue is so complex. You have to reverse it. It's a ship that you have to kind of turn around, and it takes months for it to turn around. But before I start you even on any supplements, I want you to understand why you got adrenal fatigue. And I show the patients when we do the testing, then I compare it to a normal set of adrenal glands. And I show you what happens. You know, is it because you're drinking caffeine on top of, you know, the stress, drinking caffeine, you're consuming sugars. What is your lifestyle in general?
Right.
You have to work on all those things. It would be really nice if I told everybody, well, go ahead and remove the stress. Well, you know, we can't just remove the stress. So dealing with the stress, de-stressing activities, meditation. So I have a regimen of, okay, you need to do these things. You need to understand, you need to modify your lifestyle before I even consider giving you supplements.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense. So somebody like me who meditates, you know, 20 to 30 minutes twice a day, who, you know, still has some issues, but exercises pretty regularly. And you know, I mean, I do triathlon training. And still doesn't, you know, the weight doesn't come off. And what's really funny for me, and it's really frustrating, is that, you know, I've tried these like extreme diets, right?
Wow.
And I have to be in a place where I'm eating and I'm enjoying it, because if I'm not enjoying what I'm eating, right. I'm not going to continue doing it. And so I find that for me, one of the most satisfying diets or ways to eat is more on the paleo/keto mm-hmm. style of eating. And so, but I have to probably stay away from dairy, because I tend to not be in ketosis if I eat a lot of dairy. It's very strange, my body, the way my body works. And so it's a matter of like getting my head around getting off of sugar or getting off those refined carbs and staying there. And then, you know, as soon as I'm able to do it, my brain clears up. I don't have as many symptoms. Staying off of alcohol, all that stuff. So I think a lot of our symptoms can be dealt with by our diet.
Absolutely.
And then And then we go, to, when I think we have to look at efficacy, right? And whether it, I mean, I don't know, because I'd have to see what my labs look like. And so maybe one of the things I can do for the audience, and we can make it like a series, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, is I can go through the tests and we can talk, we can talk, maybe, we can have a few of these chats going forward and I can just be a guinea pig and we can broadcast it.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing, because you are a real person and you have a stressful life, and it's just, there's just no easy answers for this weight gain or difficulty losing weight situation. You know, I go over that with my patients. I say, just like you mentioned before, yes, lack of estrogen basically signals to the brain that, oh, we've got to do something. There's no estrogen here. So the brain sends a signal to the body, says, hold on to the fatty cells because that's going to make you estrogen. So then you start ballooning up on one hand. Then we talk about your metabolism. Well, our metabolism slows down as we get older, right, whether we like it or not. And, I say on average, this is my formula that I use. I say you have to, on average, reduce your calorie intake by 150 calories a day or burn off 150 extra calories a day at the onset of menopause or perimenopause, not to lose weight, but just to maintain your weight. So the patients who come to me and they've maintained their weight, they've done a fantastic job, because usually it's the other way around.
Yeah.
You do anything and then 6 months later, you've gained 20 pounds.
Or more. I mean, for me, it was like 50 pounds and it seemed like it was overnight. And I was able to drop it. I mean, I did, so I'm kind of back to where I was before I started menopause, but I'm still in a place where I'd like to drop another 50 pounds. I mean, I would love to, you know. And the thing is that when I go off of eating a certain way, the weight will just pile right back on. And that's my own, thing. And so I have to, like, every time I go on vacation, forget it.
Yes, there's something about enjoying life too. And that's why I've never subscribed to any of the fad diets, even though they may be healthy. What I emphasize on is portion control.
Of course.
Well, that's my biggest advice to every woman out there.
Well, there's also, the technique of mindful eating that can really help as well, where, you just pay attention, you chew, you stop halfway through, you take a break, you come back, and that can really help decrease eating. But
that's kind of like the European way. You were in Europe recently, right?
I was there last year. Yeah.
Okay. But so did you notice that?
Yeah. Especially like when you go to France and try to eat a dinner in France. I mean, it's like, it's going to take 3-4 hours and it's not that many calories. It's just like the food just keeps coming, but it's really slow and you have conversation and that's kind of fun. So, okay, so let's say, all right, so we've talked about adrenal fatigue. What supplements do you recommend for adrenal fatigue? Is there anything blanket that you would say, buy this, like a regular Gaia adrenal supplement off of Amazon, or would you prefer that people kind of go through the testing? And
I prefer, if in a perfect world, I would prefer that everybody would have the testing done so I could see what their baseline is and then later on see what's happened. But I usually use, I don't like using, this may be very controversial what I say, but I don't like using Amazon. Just because the people who sell on Amazon, I'm sure a lot of them store the supplements properly, in a cool room, and they don't keep it for too long. But oftentimes, I've got a neighbor, I think that's what gave me the idea. He opened his garage door one day, and I'm like, holy cow, there's like, stacks of all these supplements and everything sitting on a shelf. And we live in Arizona, so.
Yeah, it's hot.
The garage is like 140 degrees.
Sure.
So I'm thinking, so I asked him, I'm like, what do you do? He's like, well, I sell things on Amazon. And I'm thinking, I will never buy another supplement from Amazon.
Well, I think if you buy from directly, so there is a trick to buying on Amazon. And one of the things you want to make sure is that you're buying from Amazon and not a third party seller.
Exactly.
Because Amazon itself is going to store things properly. And there are, I mean, Gaia is actually a very good supplement company.
Definitely.
I mean, if you're going to buy a supplement from a company that's, you know, I mean, Gaia is one of the most reputable ones out there.
So what I do is, I'm a pharmacist, so please forgive me if I'm really picky about supplements. That's just me.
We're talking.
Right. So, you know, I've been blamed for being analytical, and that's one of my downfalls, but then that's also one of the best things about being a pharmacist. So.
For sure.
So what I've done, you know, over years, I've done a lot of research, and I've looked into different supplements and different lines, and there are some good ones, actually, at the regular stores. But I've concluded that to put my own mind at ease and to make sure that my patients get their hands on the right supplements, I usually refer them to a website where your healthcare provider has to actually put you in the system. It's not an MLM or anything. It's just one big... It's kind of like Amazon, but for supplements only. And these are supplements that are of higher quality and only carried by healthcare providers, or your healthcare provider has to put you in the system.
It's called what? I'm sorry?
Script. FullScript.
Full script.
Full script. And okay. Script, they've got over 200 or 300 different brands of supplements, and each brand actually has got, I don't know, 100 or 200 different things, you know, from fish oil to adrenal fatigue to vitamin B, you know,
sure,
calcium, whatever. So from that, then I have my own favorites that I recommend to patients, and that's made my life so much easier, because then the patients can actually order from FullScript after, you know, I put them in the system, or there's a link that I could give to patients so they can go directly to. But they go and they see my recommendations. I have Dr. Green's favorite, you know, supplements. So patients
right.
have to go through 10,000 different things. But there are things that I like. I go on the more conservative side. So I usually recommend Adrenotone, for example, or Adaptogen, which, you know, they're very mild supplements. I don't like glandulars. Now, for those of you,
all right, so let's back up for a second.
Okay.
Let's define what an adaptogen is, because okay. you know, the audience is you know, really you know, at a basic level, so we want to make sure that they understand everything we're talking about.
Okay, fair. So adaptogens are basically herbs that help your body cope with the stress. They allow your body to kind of handle things in a better way. The things that are adaptogens are things like ashwagandha, which is
right.
a herb. There's holy basil, another herb. Eleuthero is the other one. So there are multiple ones.
What about wild yam?
Okay, so wild
yam. It's a phytoestrogen, right?
It is.
Yeah.
It's a phyto. Well. And it's more progestogenic than estrogenic.
Okay.
But I am not aware that wild yam is necessarily an adaptogen per se.
Okay.
So, but I, you know, I like things that are very...
So wild yam is progesterone in it. Progesterone.
Yeah. It's got progesterone in it. Yes.
Yeah.
Or... at least it turns into progesterone, correct?
Okay, all right. And we were talking about adaptogen, so we talked about that. And then you've got FullScript, right? And so you put people in FullScript to get that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, okay, so let's just move on from there.
So when I refer patients to FullScript, they can see specific recommendations for certain adaptogen. There's also other things that I usually recommend for them to take, such as a good B complex, vitamin C. So there's like a kind of like a list of things that I usually recommend for people who want to be treated for adrenal fatigue. And again, that's only part of the story. So I just want people to know that you can't just go buy something and then expect it to work. Oh, we were going to start talking about things, adaptogens, or not adaptogens, but adrenal fatigue supplements.
Right.
That I do not like.
Okay.
Okay. So there are certain supplements that I don't like for adrenal fatigue. And they're the ones who are glandular. So what does that mean?
That's right.
Basically, you know, for example, your thyroid gland or your adrenal glands. So the glandulars are basically made of desiccated or powdered, you know, the dry powdered form of that gland that's in a cow's body or in a pig's body. So they take the adrenal glands from the pigs, they dry them out, and then they make them into powder, and then they put them in a capsule and give it to you. And that's the way they're saying they're supporting your adrenal glands. I don't believe in that. In fact, I don't believe much in glandulars because they could actually cause more autoimmune reaction than helping you. Plus, we don't want to cause havoc in our bodies. We want things to slowly turn around and get better.
Sure. So just talk about the glandulars for a second, because Armour Thyroid is really popular. I actually take Armour Thyroid. I was taking Synthroid, and we switched it over to Armour Thyroid, and my dose went down. I felt better. So, right. I mean, I have Hashimoto's, so.
You do have Hashimoto's?
Yeah, well, that's what I was diagnosed with, but when I changed my diet, my dose went way down, and I still sometimes feel palpitations, so I might be able to reduce my dose again.
And you're right. So when we talk about autoimmune disorders, that's when I get very picky about glandulars. And that's the reason I tell people in general, I don't like glandulars, because I don't know who has autoimmune disorder, who doesn't. And I'm really glad that Armour has worked for you. We do a ton of Armour Thyroid, and we do a lot of custom compounded T3, T4 as well in the compounding pharmacy that I'm at. For some people, it works, but in general, for people who have autoimmune disorders, you have to be really careful, because it could actually backfire, and it could actually raise your antibodies.
Okay.
Attack your thyroid gland.
Okay. And do you see sometimes that like all of the immune markers go up when they take glandulars, or you know, from other, some desiccated other animal?
Yes, I've okay. seen that. That's why I hesitate.
Sure.
Glandulars to a lot of my patients with autoimmune disorder.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So an autoimmune disorder, just for the people who are watching, is something where your body kind of eats itself. So something like Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which I have had, and that I was diagnosed with that about 15 years ago. Something like a lupus or a rheumatoid arthritis. What other things are you, I'm trying to think about, you know, Crohn's disease.
But you know, I'm just amazed, you know, how much your diet affects your autoimmune disorder. So it's not just one thing. That's, you know, the glandulars are only part of the deal. But if you clean up your diet, you may see a great improvement in how you feel.
Yeah, and one thing that is really important that people don't. No, it's just not getting through. I mean, I just had a Facebook discussion about this with somebody I grew up with, and was talking about vegetable oils. Mm. And how manufactured oils are poisonous and increase inflammation in our bodies. And that's including sunflower, safflower, grapeseed, rapeseed, cottonseed, canola. All of those oils are manufactured to stay liquid at room temperature when they want to be a plastic. And learning that and getting rid of those, you know, I read Kate Shanahan's book, Deep Nutrition. And that was one of the, it was like a hallmark moment for me in terms of learning about nutrition and what's best. And then, you know, the argument back from the Facebook friend was, well, you know, what about, you know, toxins that, you know, are just in the air and stuff like that. And I'm like, well, we can't control those, but we can control what we choose to put in our body, you know, and if you like French fries, you know, or chips, like they like to say in the UK and Australia, when they're fried in those toxic oils, even after one heating, the carcinogenic potential of that oil goes up like to here. And so that really affects all of the inflammation markers across your body.
Right. I wish there people would pay more attention to that. What was the name of the book that you mentioned again?
Oh, it's Deep Nutrition by Dr. Kate Shanahan, C-A-T-E. And she was a nutritionist, or she's a doctor, but she was a nutrition consultant for the Los Angeles Lakers for a long time. Okay. And her big thing is she's got, you know, there's four pillars of human nutrition, and it's, you know, meat on the bone, the nasty bits, fresh vegetables, and I don't remember all of it, but you want to make sure that you're eating, you know, bone broth, and sometimes you want to eat, you know, organ meat, which people find really disgusting, but if it's done right, it can be very, very flavorful and better even than a steak.
Right.
And then meat that's on the bone, because that's how we were raised. And it's funny because the vegans will argue, well, we don't have the right kind of teeth, like a carnivore, right? You don't have teeth that rip flesh while it's live and that sort of thing. And it's because we are more advanced. We cook our food. It's, you know, so it's funny to see that. And now, I mean, the whole argument was around this manufactured vegan meat product that's
yeah, I've heard about that.
And apparently it tastes very similar to beef, and you can turn it into hamburgers and whatnot, but it's, you know, I haven't looked at the ingredients list, but I'm sure it's this long.
Oh yeah.
This long, and more along the lines of vegetable oil and, you know, this hydrolyzed pea protein crap and things like that, that just aren't good for you. And so, you know, while I understand that factory farming is not the best thing for the environment, I also understand that meat is good for humans.
So to get your protein.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but when you look about the whole evolution, you know, when we, whenever we came onto the scene, and I think, you know, now it's been a couple million years that humans have been on the face of the earth. It's not the 10,000 that people think. 10,000, we've been doing farming. But in terms of our hunter gatherer and that sort of thing, I mean, you know, we eat when the food's available. We're used to fasting, you know, those sorts of things. But this is not a podcast about a diet today. This is more about pharmaceuticals. So we'll go back to your thing. But I have a lot of passion about diet. A diet is really important because lifestyle management, you know, I do advocate managing menopause without any drugs if we can.
Right.
And this is a good place to talk about this newest study that just came out that said that at least a million breast cancer cases have been caused by HRT. And I don't know, I didn't read the actual study. I only read the highlights of the study that said that, you know, estrogen plus progesterone was more responsible for breast cancers than estrogen alone. So that means, you know, most women who hadn't had a hysterectomy, you know, were more at risk. And then the other thing is I didn't see if there was some sort of a distinction, and maybe you can speak to this, between hormone replacement that is like a patch or a pill versus a bioidentical.
Okay. Well, so let me tell you, thank you for bringing that up, because that is the big elephant in the room these days.
Yeah.
He wants to know what to do. And this is my personal opinion. I don't have studies to back up my opinion, but I've always believed in doing the lowest dose for the shortest period of time to bring quality of life to women.
Right. Well, let me just stop you there for 1 second. That is the North American Menopause Society stance as well, and that's the recommendation.
Correct. But, you know, I had that thought or, you know, guideline before NAMS mentioned it, and mm-hmm. even after NAMS mentioned, because this is the deal. Every other year, almost, another big study comes out, another big finding shows that they're good or they're not good. You know, it causes breast cancer, it causes blood clots, heart attacks, and strokes. There's, you know, we never know. So I come from a family of many cancers. My mom had breast cancer. That was about 22 years ago. That's how I got into what I do, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Bioidentical hormones. She had taken the commercially available estrogen that was derived from horses with synthetic progesterone, which is actually progestin. I want to distinguish between those two. So there's progesterone and then there's progestin. When we talk about progestins, they're synthetic. Progesterone is your own natural progesterone.
Okay.
So at the time, you know, there were no studies really saying that it does cause, you know, these things cause breast cancer. So my mom ended up with breast cancer, and I was mortified, and she's still with us, so
yay.
She inspires me on a daily basis to come up with non-hormonal things for women who can't use hormones. But essentially, I waited, you know, I started doing the bioidentical hormones, and I waited until back in 2002, between 2002 and 2004, there were two studies kind of came out back to back. One of them was on usage of estrogen alone in women, in postmenopausal women, and the other one was usage of estrogen plus progestin, synthetic progesterone, in women. Both of those arms of the study, it was Women's Health Initiative study.
Yeah.
So both of those arms had to be stopped because it was unethical to go forward with the studies, as they found out that the women who were taking estrogen alone had an increased risk of blood clots, heart attacks, strokes, you know. So
endometrial cancer.
Right. Well, I think those women were not, you know, basically were women who did not have a uterus. So they were not at risk for endometrial cancer. But yes, you're right. That is definitely a risk factor. Mm-hmm. So that was that arm of the study. So it did not really show an increased risk of breast cancer per se with estrogen alone. The other arm, which was estrogen with progestins, had to be stopped because of increased risk of breast cancer. So that was very interesting. So the conclusion that I made, you know, because I read all these studies, again, you have to be analytical with what
right.
you do. So the conclusion
that in school.
Yeah. Progestins, which are the synthetic progesterones, are basically the bad guys, the ones that increase the risk of breast cancer. Now, I'm not contesting the fact that estrogen alone could do that too, but there's more risk with progestins. So that was that part. Now, one more thing to mention here was that with the estrogen, again, it was the equine or the horse-derived, you know, estrogen, and it was in a pill form, and it was, for the most part, estrone. Remember going back to when we were talking about the bad sister? It was estrone primarily, right? So, you know, for that reason, we think that estrone may not be the best estrogen for us, especially if you take it orally, you know, in a tablet form or a capsule form, it may increase the risk of blood clots, heart attacks, strokes. So,
and even more if you smoke.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that's important to know. I mean, everybody, if you smoke, stop. Smoking is the worst thing you can do for yourself.
Absolutely. I don't even go there.
Yeah.
To me, there are smokers, they want hormones, I say.
I won't see patients. I mean, there are patients who want surgery. I mean, I'll operate on people who are emergencies, you know, who smoke. But for the non-emergent people, I won't do elective surgery on people who smoke. They have to find somebody else.
Right.
Yeah.
So now fast forward to 8 days ago when another study came out and everybody was like, you know, oh, what happened? What happened? Nothing happened. It was the same thing. It was basically they proved the same thing, if to make things very simple. So,
but there was a controversy because I know that about 5 years ago I was looking at the studies, and there was some study that came out that said, you know, maybe the WHI was wrong, and really there isn't an increased risk of breast cancer, so it's okay to take hormones again. And so there was a lot of confusion in the medical community about whether, and in the consumer community about whether hormone replacement was okay. And that's, right. And that's where, you know, and if it really is responsible for a million breast cancer, cases, then there's a huge, probably a huge lawsuit coming to the pharmaceutical industries because, you know, because we have seen that, you know, like a hockey stick when it comes to breast cancer, it's just, you know, really gone up.
Right.
And I think that when it comes to menopause symptoms, I think there are also environmental concerns that can make everything worse. I mean, you can eat the best, but if you're breathing air that has pollutants in it, there's not a whole lot you can do about that.
Right.
You know, if you're in a toxic mold house or something like that. So I guess then the question comes down to, is there any difference between, you know, bioidentical versus the manufactured, you know, the big pharma manufactured type hormones?
Okay. So let's talk about this study. I'm going to look at the paper in front of me because I'm accurate and give you the exact numbers. Essentially, in this study, they found a total of 108,647 women. Okay.
That's how many, that was the number of participants in the study?
Well, these were the women, they were postmenopausal women who had developed breast cancer.
Okay. So how large was the study then?
We don't know. I believe it was double that number, but their focus was only and only on these women who developed breast cancer. Now, that's where it kind of like divides up now. So these women were studied between, they took 58 studies that were actually done between 1992 and 2018. So over that course of time, they looked at all these women who developed breast cancer, right? And these women had a mean age of 65 years old. Now, half of these women had used hormones. Okay?
Youth hormones?
Had used hormones.
Had used hormones, okay.
Right. The other half had not used hormones. Very interesting. Okay. Okay? So what happens?
So this is a completely retrospective study.
Exactly.
Okay. So they looked at a whole bunch. Okay. So they're saying 50%. So they're looking at 108,000 women who had breast cancer. 50% of them
had used hormones.
And so then they extrapolated using mathematical techniques to say, oh, because 50% of the women used hormones, it's probably due to not environmental factors, but the hormones. And because of that, now we're going to extrapolate out to all the women who use hormones, and of them, the percentage is that and it's a million breast cancer cases. That's pretty much what the study says, right?
Exactly.
So it's all a bunch of math, and we don't know. You know, the study could be super flawed.
So, again, I look at things very carefully because I don't want to make any conclusions one way or another. But one thing that we know is that 50% of these women had not used hormones. So what was the contributing factor? But let's look at the ones who did develop breast cancer and they had used hormones. So I'm going to give you some statistics here. On average, the chances or the risk of developing breast cancer in a typical woman of normal weight between the ages of 50 and 65 is 6.3 per 100. So if you take 100 women in a room between the ages of 50 and 65, and they all have relatively normal weight, then 6.3 of those women are going to get breast cancer, right? So that's the baseline. That's what we're comparing the rest of the study with, all right? Mm-hmm. So then they estimated that in women who had used hormones for 5 years, this is what happened. If they'd used estrogen and progestogens, and I'm going to explain to you what that is. If they had used the combination of those two for 5 years, every day with no break, that increased the risk to basically 2 per 100 women. So by 2 per 100 women. So it increased it from 6.3 to 8.3.
Right. Okay.
Now, what are progestogens? Progestogens are essentially progesterone, which could be natural or bioidentical, going back to what you were asking, and it could be the synthetic ones. I really dug through that study to find out exactly how many women had used natural progesterone. There was a mention of micronized natural progesterone, but there was no numbers. Very few, but I don't know how many. Another source told me 58 women of all these, you know, hundreds of thousands of women had used
micronized
progesterone, but I don't know for a fact if that was the case. So we lump sum all of them together, and these were both the topical, you know, estrogen, the patches and creams, and the oral estrogens. Okay, so that was that part of it. Then they had another group of women whose risk went up by less than 2%. So it went up by 1.4. And that was the group of women who took the estrogen every day of the month, every day of the year for 5 years. But the progestogen part of it was cyclical. So they probably took 2 weeks on, 1 week off, or 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. that type of thing. That one increased the risk of breast cancer by a little bit less than taking it every day.
Right.
The third part of the study was women who took only estrogen and no progesterone. So these women, I assume, did not have a uterus. They were not,
yeah,
need progesterone. So only estrogen for 5 years, that increased the risk of breast cancer by 0.5%.
So right, so it's a lot less. So we think that the breast cancer is maybe related to the progestins or the,
yes,
type of
progestins, right,
yeah, progesterones. So the question that I have, and I think that probably my listeners will have, is that, you know, many of us took birth control,
right,
for years and years. So
yep.
Where does birth control fit in this whole study? I mean, is it similar? Is it not? Is there risk, you know, to breast cancer because of the use of birth control?
Yes, birth control pills were included in this study. Okay. So when we talk about those women who took it non-cyclical or cyclical, basically meaning 3 weeks on, 1 week off, they were primarily the birth control arm.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So even if they weren't menopausal, if they took birth control at some point in their life, they may have a higher risk of breast cancer.
The thing is that these women were primarily 50 to 65 years of age.
I think it would be really interesting to see if we could do some sort of retrospective study. Now, I don't know, you know, if this is even possible, but to see if, rather than environmental issues being the cause of breast cancer, maybe it's the birth control pill.
Oh yeah, that's a big risk in my opinion.
Yeah,
so, let me tell you, when you talk about environmental factors, you are so right. So as I'm doing this research and I'm like paying real attention to the numbers, I come across the most interesting things. So in this day and age, a lot of women are into drinking wine, you know, a glass of wine every night with dinner or something. But very interesting, because just drinking alcohol alone increases your risk of breast cancer tremendously. Women who have, this is based on American Cancer Society, women who have 3 alcoholic drinks per week have a 15% higher risk of breast cancer.
So that's higher than even taking hormones. So maybe alcohol is the reason. So, you know, I think at the bottom line is, we still don't know. And
right,
maybe
right,
hormones are to blame. Maybe they aren't. A lot of people can't take hormones because they have a family history of breast cancer, or because they don't want to, or they've got other sorts of issues, you know, blood clotting or that sort of thing, you know, history of pulmonary embolism or history of some sort of deep vein thrombosis.
Right.
And so in those cases, then, you know, we advocate lifestyle. So, so we're coming to the end of our time. I don't want to take it out too much longer. So I'd like to have you back.
Okay.
You know, and maybe we can do this, you know, regularly, but one of the things I'd like to do is maybe, you know, maybe I can just become a guinea pig and we can kind of go through a consultation and do all that, you know, on the podcast, you know, and hopefully increase your patient base as well.
Great.
As
I'd
we go.
Me too. I'd be happy.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, what I can do is, you know, I do have access to any laboratory tests you want, because I can order them for myself.
That's right.
And then if, you know, you can let me know what labs you want me to order, and then I can send off the saliva. And we can, you know, we could maybe, I think that the, you know, if the viewers are interested, we could certainly do that, and we can see what it's like. Now, in the meantime, where can people find you?
The best way to get a hold of me right now, because my website is under construction, is to email me at AZ, like Arizona, or hormonehelpers@hotmail.com.
Okay, so it's azhormonehelpers@hotmail.com. And then I want to have you back to talk about women's sexual health, because I know you have a product that you've developed for vaginal dryness. And if you want to just talk about that really briefly, and then we'll spend some more time talking about sexual health on our
Absolutely.
Next talk.
So my mom had breast cancer, and I told you, we have these discussions, what are you going to do for those of us who can't use hormones? And I developed FabuVag based on a study that showed the ingredient in it actually helps with vaginal dryness and atrophy, and also sexual functions. So it's available online if anybody cares to take a look at it. FabuVag,
F-A-B-U-V-A-G,
just like fabulous vagina.
Yeah, F-A-B-U-V-A-G, and is that .com?
Yes, FabuVag.com.
All right, great. Okay, well, Dr. Green, thanks so much for joining us in the podcast this time, and we're definitely going to have you back soon.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.